Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thank you for tuning into the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you from the wonderfully cozy studio in the back of Roberta's restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you are listening to Good Food, the show where we talk with people who are using food as a vehicle for social good. I'm your host, Daniel Meyer, and I am thrilled to be joined today by Marco Canora. You may know Marco as the chef and owner of Hearth Restaurant in the East Village and of Terroir Wine Bars. You might know him as the author of the wonderful cookbook called Salt to Taste, or maybe as the guy who cooked his way to the finale of the next Iron Chef America competition on the Food Network. But you may not know him for his philanthropic work in the food world, so I'm particularly delighted to be able to pick his brain about that today, and of course all the rest of what he does as well. Chef Canora, thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Thank you, Daniel. It's an honor to be on the network. I really love what you guys are doing out there.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you so much. So clearly from my intro, it's obvious that you do all sorts of incredibly interesting things, and I figure there's no reason not to touch on as many of them as we can today. But I'd love to start out with a few things that may not be so much on people's radars, given what they know about you. The first, which I want to get to right away, is a major dinner that's coming up towards the end of this month that you're hosting for a really incredibly worthy cause. Will you tell us what's the dinner? What are you up to?
We're doing something for the ALS Foundation, a life story foundation started by a guy by the name of Kevin Swan. Kevin Swan was an employee of ours back in 2010. He was a server at Hearth, part of our small intimate family here. He subsequently left, moved out to Chicago, and in 2012 was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. Which we had another friend in our universe, Jerry Hayden, who is Claudia Fleming's husband, who I had worked with Claudia at Gramercy Tavern back in the day. And he, too, got diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. So, a manager at the time, Jared Roth, and my chef de cuisine, George Caden, they both kind of came up with this idea of trying to do a benefit dinner for the ALS Foundation. And we did our first one last year. And we had, a bunch of guest chefs, Sean Brock and Shane McMullen, they all came. And we had a really wonderful night. And we, just a bunch of people gathered in our dining room. And we raised a substantial amount of money for the cause. And we felt that it was such a success that we want to continue to do it on an annual basis. So this year, we got a new roster of chefs. We have Andrew Carmelini coming, and Michael Simon's coming, and Seamus is coming back.
Wow.
And we're really thrilled. It's a couple weeks away, and we're really thrilled to be doing it again.
So how do you go about organizing an event like this? Obviously, you have a great cause. You have a ton of motivation, but then you sort of have an empty restaurant and a blank slate. How do you go about collecting the chefs? Do you approach them? Do they know about it from you? How do you start to piece a dinner like this together?
Well, the reason why I think you see it happening so often in our world of restaurants is that, each restaurant, we keep a customer list. So it's very easy to do reach out to our fans.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Swan, who started the Love Story Foundation, he has all of his fingers out there in the networking world. And, we do something that everybody kind of has interest in, and that is, serving you great food and great wine and great hospitality. And, it's kind of the perfect vehicle to garner interest and to have people reach into their pocketbooks and donate for a great cause.
Yeah. So it's a few weeks away. Can you give us a little sneak, a little taste of what might be on the menu?
You know, I don't even know if everything's finalized. I know Michael Simon's going to do some kind of pig ear and watermelon salad.
Okay, nice.
We're doing our lamb dish, which is smoked rib and roasted loin with a bunch of late season eggplants from the green market. I'm not exactly sure what everybody else is doing.
All right, good enough. I imagine it's totally full up. Are there tickets left, or is it you're done for this year?
There are still tickets available.
Really?
You can buy them online at a Life Story Foundation. .org.
Okay.
And you can just kind of click there and do it. The ticket price is $325. It's a little bit higher than what we did last year, but we thought that we had such a good turnout and that, you know, this is really for the cause. It's not, you know, to go into our coffers. And there are absolutely still tickets available. We have two more weeks to do it. So any interest, please come join us and have a great night.
Fantastic. All right, if you're listening and this piques your interest, with it, which it probably does, alifestoryfoundation.org is where you can get tickets. So I wanted to ask you, you know, if I had a talent like you do, through which I could consistently get people to open up their pocketbooks, as you say, and, pay lots of money for great food and great wine and great hospitality, you know, my impulse would be to want to do that all the time. But obviously, you know, you run businesses, so you can't really be in the business of giving your money away all the time.
Right.
How do you decide when and how often to, you know, transform yourself from a restaurateur and businessman into a philanthropist? And how do you decide which causes are worthy of,
right,
of doing that for?
You know, that's a really great question, one that I think a lot of us in the industry struggle with.
Yeah.
We are asked so many times throughout a given year to participate in this fundraiser and that walk around tasting, and man, if I said yes to all of them, I don't think we would still be here. it's just not viable.
Yeah.
And you know, what amazes me is this notion that, like, listen, the restaurant business for the vast majority of us is not a notoriously big margin business.
Right.
And it's kind of, I think it says a lot to the type of people who get into our industry, that, you know, we're really not the motivating factor behind opening up a restaurant. Usually is not to make money. There's small margins, there's incredibly high costs. There's always exceptions, you know, out there of restaurants that are making a killing, but you know, we enjoy making people happy, and we're in the hospitality business, and I think it's quite something and admirable that in our industry you see a lot of this kind of thing, a lot of money raising for great causes. And, you know, how do you determine it? Well, for this one it was easy because it really touched close to home.
Right, sure.
You know, when Sandy happened, the same thing, it was really in our backyard. It affected people and it really motivated me to get involved. And I think that, you know, for us, it's like if we have some kind of connection to it, we typically say yes, which is a lot of them. I mean, we do a lot of hunger release things. We do Autism Speaks every year. But I tell you, it is incredibly difficult to say no.
I'll bet. So you do these. So you do multiple fundraisers at your restaurant, not even just participating in things that other people are. Other people,
you know,
are doing?
I would say the majority of them are at off-premises events,
yeah,
where they rent out a space and it's for a cause. You know, the big nut to crack by doing it in your establishment, we're open 7 nights a week. So
right,
it's not only we raise money for a cause, but we actually say goodbye to the money that
right
would have come in revenue-wise. So, you know, I would say 2 to 3 times a year we close shop and do it for a cause. You know, this fall, November 20th, winter actually, is going to be our 10th year anniversary.
Wow.
And
congratulations.
Thank you very much. And I'm getting 10 chefs, and Paul Greco, my partner, is bringing in 5 sommeliers, and we're going to have a blowout dinner, 10 courses, 10 chefs kind of thing. And we are going to give all the proceeds to a local church in our neighborhood. And that's going to be another, you know, fun, cool way to kind of give back to the neighborhood and kind of thank them for, you know, supporting us for so many years. And you know, we obviously believe that it's an incredibly important thing to support your hood that you're in, and I'll tell you that I really learned that value in my days at Gramercy Tavern with Danny Meyer, who was a huge advocate of this idea of taking care of your neighborhood.
Interesting. So that has stuck with you, obviously.
It absolutely has stuck with me.
So I also read recently about, and this was unrelated to my knowing that I was going to be talking to you. I also read about a program called New Roots, which is run by the International Rescue Committee. And I start reading mm-hmm. about it, and then it turns out that you are intimately involved with that too. Will you tell us about that that program and the work that you do?
I think intimately may be a stretch. Michelle Nishan is a good friend of mine who I admire for quite a while. Mm-hmm. He's intimately involved.
Okay.
He asked if I would be a part of a few kind of fundraisers that he had done, and I agreed and did a few visits to a kind of a farm that they have up in the Bronx, where these refugees are taken in and they're given a plot of land to kind of grow and do what they wish with. And it was an unbelievable experience. I'm incredibly honored and proud to be a part of it in the periphery of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of our nature to want to do good out there. I mean, we are, living in New York, being a chef, having a restaurant, going to the Green Market, doing all the things that we take advantage of. It's like, you know, it's important to be reminded and this idea of having gratitude for all that we have. I mean, it's easy to lose sight of it in our daily grind. And I think it's important to do these kinds of things. And you see how much need there is out there in the world and how many people are hungry and how many people are dying of diseases that there isn't good fundraising and research for. And there's so much to do out there in the way of, donating time and effort and energy.
Do you think that chefs, because they're in the business of, you know, not only making customers happy, but of cooking for people, of nourishing people, do you feel particularly sort of attuned to wanting to help people, not just in food-related endeavors, but sort of generally, you think that a chef has a particular sensitivity to wanting to help?
Yes. And listen, it's not by accident that you see so much of this work happening in our industry.
Yeah.
It's because it's innate. It's inherent in the fact that we do what we do. We like to nourish people. We like to feed people. We like that feedback. It's satisfying on a real level, you know, on a deeper kind of level. And you know, I think in one way or another, it feeds us all in a way that, you know, dollars and cents don't feed people.
So chefs are, you know, as a chef, you're obviously you're a leader in your own kitchen, and obviously you yourself seem to be a leader in the community. Is it fair of, you know, normal people who eat and dine at restaurants to expect chefs to be sort of leaders and out in the forefront of larger food movements? Is that a fair expectation? Should we look at you and think that you should be a model of charity and sustainability and all that, or is that just a burden that you put on yourself?
Well, listen, I think anybody who is a business owner, who is successful and is managing a way to create a certain lifestyle for themselves and be a part of a community and reap the benefits of being part of that community mm-hmm. should have some sense of a desire to give back. And I won't, you know, I'm not going to, you know, have an attitude towards somebody who chooses not to. It's obviously their choice. But on a fundamental level, I think it's the right thing to do. And I realize that not everybody might think that, but for me and for a lot of my buddies who are chefs, who I see at these annual events all the time, I think they feel the same way. So, you know, I just think we kind of, we owe it to our communities and to the people at large out there to kind of give back a little bit.
Well, I have no doubt that there is a lot of people who are tremendously grateful that you and your colleagues feel that way. So we are talking with Marco Canora. We need to take a quick break, but we will be right back. Stay tuned.
Ooh, You're listening to Help Me Now by the California Honey Drops on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. In our industrial world, most wines have become brands, but the wines I love are so much more. Fine wine is a civilizing substance that connects us to nature. It cannot be stamped out in a factory. If you're listening to this great show, you probably eat different. I urge you to drink different too. Go deeper. Cane5.com.
Yes, I was. We are back. You're listening to Good Food on the Heritage Radio Network, and we have been talking with Chef Marco Canora about his excellent charitable endeavors. I feel like we could probably talk about those for the rest of the show, but I want to make sure that we get into some of the other amazing and interesting things that you seem to be up to. So I've read about this, and I've heard about this this yearly cooking class that you lead in Tuscany, where you bring some group of obviously incredibly lucky people to a villa there, and you cook with them for some period of time. Will you tell us about that? Just so we can I'll be sufficiently jealous. Will you walk us through a day there? What is that like?
Absolutely. Oh, I would love to.
Okay, fantastic.
My friend Jens, he bought an estate on the top of a hill outside of Siena. It's a 1,000-year-old. He restored the entire thing, and it's it's stunning. It's like perfect Tuscan ideal surroundings. He has chickens and guinea hens and pigs. And he has huge gardens, and he has 3,000 olive trees, and he has capers growing on the walls. And it is a fantasy world for a chef like myself. And he posed this idea of trying to do these cooking classes. And we're 4 years in now, and it's just 10 people a year. You come from Saturday to Saturday. You stay on premises, and, we cook in the morning our lunch, and we cook in the afternoon our dinner. We do a few little wine trips here and there. We go to Florence for a day and look at art. And it's just a stunning week. A lot of eating, a lot of drinking, a lot of camaraderie. I'm teaching people some skills so they could really expand their repertoire. And, it's just filled with a lot of eating and drinking and learning. And it's an awesome week.
All right, I'm more jealous than I thought I would be when I asked that question. But who are the students that you bring? Where do they come from?
Oftentimes they're regulars at the restaurant part.
Oh, great.
We kind of advertise here within these walls.
Mm-hmm.
I've had people come from the West Coast. I've had people from all over, and it's nice because it's intimate. It's only 10 of us, and we kind of gather around the table every night and eat under the stars. My favorite night is the final night. It's the Friday night before they leave on Saturday morning, and we stoke up the 1,000-year-old pizza oven.
Wow!
And we get a local pizzaiola in, and he makes this huge wad of dough, and everybody kind of tries out trying to make little individual pizzas, and we all kind of make pizza and eat pizza and drink beer and drink wine outside, and it's our final kind of bon voyage party.
Does not sound bad.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I mean, really, as a chef, you're really you're a professional cooking teacher. I mean, I imagine you're always teaching your cooks and the people you work with. But how is it different to have a group of, novices in the kitchen?
Well, first of all, I'm not paying them, and they're paying me. So that really changes the dynamic.
So it's a much more amicable relationship there.
I would say so. Yes. I try to keep it really light. It's really, you can kind of get as involved or as you want. I mean, if you ever want to bow out and go sit by the pool and read, you're more than welcome to do that. It's not.
You don't tell your line cooks that at the restaurant?
No, I absolutely don't. It's not a disciplined endeavor, the cooking class. It's really about having fun and learning a little bit. But you're right, you know, teaching is something that every chef in every restaurant, you know, teaching is part of the job. So I think inherently we make great teachers because that's what we do for a living. And I personally, I find it incredibly rewarding, and I find it, I enjoy the process of teaching. I really do.
And how does that, now how does that translate to, I mean, it seems you teach in a number of different ways. You also wrote a book, Salt to Taste, which is a really beautiful book. If anyone listening wants to check it out, they should.
Thank you.
Which sort of, it seems to be about kind of bringing your, you know, bringing your wisdom as a chef to home cooks and distilling it down for people in the home kitchens. What's that process like as a as an act of teaching?
You know, that book was really meant to do exactly what you said, and I'm so happy you said it, but I really wanted to distill it down. You know, with every passing week or month or year, you hear how cooking is really, you know, people are interested in cooking in terms of watching it, but nobody's doing it.
Right.
And, you know, that's something that I really, you know, I really want to get involved with this movement back to cooking, and I really will do everything I can to kind of make sure it doesn't go the way of darning your own socks. I think that cooking,
right,
like, you know, Michael Pollan's latest book called Cooked is really all about that that conversation of, you know, the most important thing we can do as a society to kind of battle our issues with obesity and sickness is to get back in the kitchen and cook again and not rely on big food to cook for us. And that's something that I really, that really rings true in my mind. And I want to be out there and show everybody that, you know what, it's not that hard to cook and it doesn't take that long and it's totally worth the effort. And it's a satisfying process that really feeds you on many levels and not just on the nourishment side, but artistically and on so many levels. So I have been for quite a while now on a serious mission to spread the word of, you know, cooking is easy and cooking is fun and cooking is fundamental.
What do you think the biggest, what have you found is the biggest impediment that that people face between, you know, if they're sitting on the couch watching TV but they have no impulse to go into the kitchen and cook it? Why is it such a big hurdle to clear?
You know, that's a great question, and there's a lot of things that come up in this debate that you know, I find, you know, pretty annoying. And one is that this idea of, like, oh, it's an elitist, you know, this elitist stand, and like, oh, yeah, you're a chef in New York, and you go shopping at the Green Market, and you're just some privileged elitist,
right,
telling me that I need to cook. And, you know, listen, I'm aware of the world, and I'm aware of the food deserts, and I'm aware of all of these things, but don't try to tell me that, you know, cooking for your family or cooking for yourself and starting with whole natural food is an elitist notion. I mean, in Europe, you know, it was a peasant notion that you ate and off the land and you cooked that way. And it was an affordable, wholesome, nourishing way to feed yourself. And granted, it's hard to justify it in the city or with, you know, a Kentucky Fried Chicken on the corner where you can get a whole lot of calories for a very little amount of money. But you know what? It's on the verge of poison, this stuff.
Right.
And I think that there needs to be education out there. And I want to be part of that conversation, and I want to be involved.
So if you had one shot at convincing somebody who wasn't a cook to get in the kitchen, one dish to show them how to make, and you can say, this is simple, it's delicious, it's healthy, it's inexpensive, what would you teach them how to cook?
It is the first recipe you stumble upon on my Salt to Taste book, which is eggs and tomato sauce.
Oh,
it's like,
nice.
You get that anywhere. You got dried, you know, there's not a supermarket across this entire country that doesn't have canned tomatoes, that doesn't have eggs, that doesn't have dried oregano and garlic and olive oil. I mean, this is not an elitist dish. This is a simple, fast, delicious, wholesome, tasty as hell dish that you can make in 15 minutes flat. So, you know, that there's a reason why that was the first recipe in my book, because that exemplifies my point.
Eggs poached in tomato sauce. Sounds pretty good.
Yep. Yeah, it's tremendous.
So I wanted to ask you about sort of the idea of the general idea of salting to taste, not just as it's in your book, but sort of generally.
Uh-huh.
It's that, you know,
sure.
You're cooking at home and you season as you go, and you sort of use your own, you know, unique sense of taste and your preferences as a guide to sort of tell you how to cook. You know, when we're cooking at home, obviously in the comfort of our own walls, we can really do whatever crazy things we want. If I want to put,
yep.
you know, sriracha on my spaghetti and meatballs, you know, that's what I'm going to do. But, you know, when we go as diners, when we go out to restaurants, it's obviously not such a free for all. We still have preferences, but then, you know, we are sort of given what the chef gives us. I'm wondering if you ever get customers who, you know, sort of try to impose their particular tastes onto what you're cooking. Do you get crazy requests? Do you accommodate them? Do you deny them? What's your responsibility in that situation as a, you know, as a chef who has principles but who's trying to make, you know, their customers happy?
You know, this is going to come across as lame, but it depends. Generally, though, I will say that, you know, at heart, we're a casual place. We're at a certain price point. It's not cheap, but it's not $250 a head, like some of these places.
Right.
There's an a la carte menu with many offerings. We obviously get special requests all the time. I mean, New York City diners, they know what they want, and
right.
they're not afraid to ask us for it. And, you know, my direction to all the chefs that work for me is that, you know, if we can do it and it doesn't affect the flow of other people's experience and we're able to do it, then we should go out of our way to do it. I mean, I believe that we are in the hospitality business and we are in the service industry. And if somebody wants me to put eggplant on the salmon and the eggplant is on the lamb, but they love eggplant and they want salmon, like, I'm going to get a handful of the fairy tale eggplant I'm getting from the green market, and I'm going to saute them up and put them on the salmon. And I don't really take offense to that anymore. I think, you know, I've kind of grown up a little bit from maybe, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago when I started, and I was like, you know, there's no way in hell I'm going to give you that. Like, you know, I have all these, you know, you have all this stuff to prove, I think, when you're younger.
Right.
And starting out. And I've come to realize that it's like, you know what? If you could do it, do it. Like, you're going to make them happy. You're going to win them over. There's really no rationale behind not doing it. I mean, listen, if somebody says, hey, Marco, can you dump some A1 steak sauce on the steak too? You know, I'm going to say, well, we don't have A1 steak sauce.
Right.
So I'm sorry, but we can't.
Right.
So, you know, it depends on how absurd the request is. But generally, they're not absurd, and if I can accommodate them, I do.
I think that's a great policy. So we have just a minute or two left, so I wanted to ask you one more question, sort of similar to what you just said between the difference between the beginning of your career and now. You know, you started as a cook in a time sort of before celebrity chefdom was really much of a thing,
yeah.
and you've continued working on through the time where that phenomenon has, you know, totally taken off. And now it might even be fair to say after your, you know, your TV stardom that you are a celebrity chef yourself. I'm wondering, what's it been like to see, you know, not just to you know, become more successful and more famous yourself, but what's it been like to see the identity and sort of the possibilities of your profession change so much over the time that you've been working in it?
Yeah, my God. I mean, listen, man, this is that is such a huge question that I would love to talk about that for hours.
You can't answer that in the 1 minute that we have left. You'll come back. You come back sometime.
Listen,
we'll talk about it.
I will spin this very positive and say that, like, I think ultimately it's a good thing. I think it raises awareness about the importance of food. It raises awareness about the importance of cooking.
Yeah.
I think that it gives us a platform to kind of send messages and educate people where we didn't have that platform before. You know, I hope that we, as a community of chefs, kind of get on the right bandwagons by taking advantage of that in a positive way. But I think that ultimately it's a good thing.
Okay, fair enough. That's a good answer. If you ever want to expound on that more, you can come back anytime.
I appreciate that.
Very good. So we're out of time. I want to thank our guest, Marco Canora, for chatting with us today. Marco, it was really a pleasure. You've been listening to Good Food on the Heritage Radio Network, and I'll talk to you again in a few weeks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.